Welcome to Resilience in Life and Leadership with your host, Stephanie Olson, speaker, author, addiction, sexual violence, and resiliency expert. Hello, welcome to Resilience in Life and Leadership. Sue Bowles is a survivor turned award-winning author, speaker, and master certified professional coach. She leads My Step Ahead, an organization committed to breaking the stigma around mental health struggles. You only have to be one step ahead to help the person behind you, is the bedrock to the value Sue brings. She helps stuck people get unstuck by discovering hope, journeying together for the next step ahead. Whether speaking on a podcast stage or one-on-one, Sue's enthusiasm is contagious, shining the light of hope wherever the listener needs, cheering them to see their dreams become present reality. Welcome, Sue.
Hello, and welcome to Resilience in Life and Leadership. And I am here with Sue Bowles. Sue, welcome.
Hello, Stephanie. Looking forward to this. Thanks for having me.
Oh, gosh. Thank you for being on. You've got quite a story. And I'm really excited to hear it. Right now, you're a coach and you're doing a whole bunch of things to help people. You're an author. But why don't you tell me how you got to where you are today?
It is a bit of a journey. just a little bit.
Yes.
And it's a 180 from where I was headed. So as I get into this, let me give your listeners a quick trigger warning here. A couple of things I'm getting ready to talk about have to do with sexual assault. Has to do with eating disorders and being suicidal. So if any of those topics can be potential triggers for you, please, if you need to shut the show off and come back later and make sure you have a self-care plan in place, please do that. I never want my story to do harm to anybody else. That's not what I do this for. It's the exact opposite. I want my story to help other people.
I really appreciate that. Thank you so much, Sue.
So having said that, life has been a lot of twists and turns, and I didn't know it. And it starts in first grade when, after school one day, a classmate enticed me into the woods on school property after school, held me against my will for 45 minutes, and proceeded to rape me more than once.
I'm so sorry.
Thanks.
A first grader did this.
First grade, seven years old.
Wow.
And I'll come back to that in a little bit of how things have turned so much. But Bobby's last words to me put me in a prison, and I didn't know that I was being sentenced that day. And he simply said, "Don't tell anybody." And I didn't know what had happened. And mind you, this is early 70s. So rape was not on the radar.
We were not talking about it.
You weren't talking about it. You might not even known what it was. Mm-hmm. You certainly weren't talking about it with a 7-year-old.
No,
it just wasn't on the radar. So I am very quick to say that the only person who did anything wrong that day was the boy who raped me.
That's right.
It took me a long time to buy into that, though. Mm-hmm. That was part of the healing journey, but that it ended up becoming a 15-year secret over a decade.
My gosh.
And it came out my senior year of college. I think it was a couple months before I graduated. And I was in a conversation with the person who was my dean of students. He had moved on to another position, but he had kind of become my confidant and counselor over the 4 years. And I didn't know that it wanted to come out. Mm-hmm. And it kind of came out and surprised me and surprised him at the same time.
Yeah.
Now, in between that 15 years of being in prison versus getting out of prison, there was a lot more that happened. There were other sexual assaults from some neighborhood kids. There was, I grew up in an alcoholic, a dysfunctional family. Yeah. So as the alcohol started taking over in some in high school, but even more so in college, it showed, as in any situation when you have an addiction happening, there's some emotional abuse that happens. I want to be very quick to say that all the relationships have been restored, and they're actually better than they have ever been.
Wow, that's amazing.
We have all done the hard work of healing, and we'll come back to that too.
Yes.
But in the course of all that, twice I was suicidal. I did not attempt, but I was to the point I was ready to. I developed an eating disorder in college.
Yeah.
And anyone who's familiar with that knows that an eating disorder is an addiction.
Yeah.
It is shrouded in secrecy.
Yes.
And what I've learned as I wrote the book, I learned a lot about myself in that process. And one of the things that I came to realize, even though I knew I was insecure in college, I didn't really have an understanding of how that was coming out. I kind of knew, but I didn't know how to explain it.
Right.
I couldn't identify it. It was just who I was and what I did.
What
I ended up doing was I realized that I didn't feel like I mattered.
Yeah.
I felt like I was a waste of space.
Yeah.
And so if I was seen, I felt I got my value by being seen.
Mm-hmm.
So I got over-involved in campus activities because what I ended up learning is that if I was seen, I felt like I had value.
Sure.
And
if
I had value, I mattered.
Wow.
So there was that going on behind the scenes. But then the other part of it was that with the eating disorder, eating disorders have nothing to do with food. Absolutely nothing.
All control.
it's control, trying to control something in your life that feels out of control, even if you can't identify it yet.
Right. Right.
And I've come to learn what those issues were, but they have to do with emotions that have not been resolved about.
Right.
And usually has to do with some kind of trauma or something in your background that hasn't been resolved. It's really not about self-image because even self-image issues, when you strip it down, have to do with something else.
That's right.
Self-image is like a secondary issue. There's still something underneath. What is that insecurity, that anxiety, that fear, that lie you're being told underneath the insecurity? That's what the root issue is.
Yeah.
So it's even just kind of having to drill down really deep to get to the roots. So, but with the eating disorder, if I stayed busy, I didn't have to think. And if I didn't have to think, I didn't have to feel. And if I didn't have to feel, I didn't have to deal with my stuff.
That's right.
So I was in avoidance like crazy.
Mm-hmm.
So we had all that going on. And you know, going back to 7 years old, you know, there's a lot of studies out, you see them on the internet, scans of the brain, that trauma literally rewires your brain.
Yes.
Because you go into fight, flight, or freeze.
That's right.
And your brain processes things in one of those three channels. So here I was at 7 years old when your mind is really starting to develop it. You know, they call it the age of reason, you know, and I didn't have a chance to be a normal kid because from the start, I was operating in either fight, flight, or freeze. And I froze. My emotions were frozen in time that day. And the longer you're in the freezer, the thicker the ice gets.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Think of that item that's in the back corner of your freezer.
That's right. That's right.
Frost on it. And you're like, wow, I didn't know that was there. How much frost accumulates the longer that thing is stuck back there?
Yeah.
That's what was going on with my
emotions.
What
a great analogy. I like that. Wow.
So that is what was. And for the longest time, I let those events define me. I was raped. I was this. This happened to me. And that was my identity. But that's not who I am. Those are events. Those are sad, heartbreaking events. Those are traumatic, life-altering events. But they're not who I am. And they're not, I convinced myself they were who I was, but it wasn't.
Right.
And through a whole lot of hard work of healing over a number of years, decades, those events don't define me anymore. Mm-hmm. I define the effect they have on me because I have come out on top. Now they are scars that tell a story of hope.
Yes.
And I use that word scars because all of us are wounded. All of us have things that hurt or we have been injured. Think about when you cut your arm or you maybe need stitches. You have a wound on your arm and it's bleeding. And it is susceptible to infection unless you properly treat it. You could put a little Band-Aid over it, but if you need 5 stitches, a Band-Aid's not going to do you any good. And instead, it's going to be even more susceptible to infection. So taking that analogy and applying it to my trauma, I had life-altering events, and they were wounds, but I was not treating them. I was putting a Band-Aid on them, and it got infected even more.
Wow, yeah.
And the more infection there is, the harder it is, the longer it takes to heal. You have to have more treatment, do more things to, if you know, that cut, if you don't get the stitches right away, and it's, you know, you're going to have even more, it's going to hurt more to heal the longer you take to deal with it.
Right.
So I have gone through that process, thankfully. Gut wrenching, not for the faint of heart, wouldn't trade a second of it for the world. Mm. But now I have healed wounds. And when you know, after you get your stitches out, you have a scar there. And someone says, hey, what happened to your arm? You're telling them the story of your scar.
Yeah.
So I now have scars, emotional scars, that are now stories of hope for others that help light their path for whatever they're going through.
That is what it's all about. That is so important. So now, can we talk a little bit about the eating disorder and how you went into recovery for that? So what eating disorder did you have?
I am in recovery from OSFED, which stands for Other Specified Feeding and Eating Disorder. And it's actually cool because they were recording this. This week is National Eating Disorder Awareness Week. By the time this airs, it'll be passed. But
yeah,
I did a presentation at work this morning about eating disorders because it's all about raising that awareness. The eating disorder I have is not one of the big three people think about. You think eating disorder, first
anorexia,
of all, I have
bulimia, and what I mean, I have binge eating disorder as well as recovery from anorexia, bulimia, and binge eating disorder.
Yep. But yeah, those are the three.
Binge eating disorder is kind of newer in the realm of conversation. Yeah,
right. Yeah, those are the three big ones. The handout I put out today, there are 12 different types of eating disorders. Now, some of them, and some of them are not, I think there's only five that are in the actual DSM manual for diagnoses in the medical field, but mental health professionals also address and acknowledge these other ones. So there are some I had not heard of, which was kind of interesting, but anyway, so the eating disorder I have means that I don't fit all the diagnostic criteria for any other eating disorder. Which adds to the stigma, because when people, my guess is when your listeners hear the word eating disorder, they get an image in their mind, most likely either skin and bones or really overweight. And I am neither.
Right.
And if I don't tell people that I'm in recovery from an eating disorder, they would probably never know. Because here's the thing, there is no look to an eating disorder.
That's correct.
Disorders affect men and women. They are the second most lethal of all mental health struggles.
Yeah.
Second only to opioid addiction. And that is only a more recent flip. These eating disorders used to be the most lethal, not only because of the suicide, but then also because of the damage that is done to the body.
So
there's so much misinformation out there about eating disorders. It's not a diet gone bad. It's not about vanity. It's not about any of that. It's an addiction. And whatever the issue is behind the scenes, that's how it comes out.
Right.
The difference is that in any other addiction, one of the big keys to recovery is to abstain.
Yeah.
My brother and my dad are in recovery from alcoholism. They abstain from alcohol.
Yep. So a whole lot easier to do.
Right. An eating disorder, you can't abstain from food if you want to live.
No, that's one of the problems.
That's the problem, you know? So you have to figure out how to have a good relationship with food, where food is no longer the enemy.
Which is
and when I first heard that phrase, relationship with food, I'm like, what?
Mm-hmm.
And it makes sense now.
Yeah.
Because if you have angst towards eating, you have angst in that relationship.
That's right. Wow. So that's really good. I think people really struggle with that a lot. And I think eating disorders are such an epidemic. And for that very reason, and I think about all that has happened recently with the pandemic and, you know, people who are having disordered eating throughout that with all of the anything in the mental health arena. It's just been a very, very difficult struggle for people.
Yeah. It has. And you know, if one good thing has come from the pandemic, it's that mental health and eating disorders have come to the forefront.
Yeah.
Yeah. So people are talking about it more. School counselors are more aware of it. Parents are more aware of it. Even the medical field is finally more aware of it. Because, and I say that because BMI is not an indication of health.
No kidding. Thank you.
BMI does not take into consideration muscle mass.
Nope.
Which is more dense and heavier than fat.
That's right.
So if your doctor's only looking at your weight compared to your height, and they think you're overweight, which in my case, my BMI with my doctor would tell her I'm overweight. Trust me, I'm not overweight.
Yes.
You know, I tell the story. It's kind of funny because my last checkup last year, she's looking through my chart. And I hear, and I'm like, I know what she's looking at because, and I'm like, I know what's going on here. and she looks at me, she says, well, you didn't get any shorter. So I really knew what she was talking about. And I'm like, don't make me educate you. You're not going to like it if I have to explain BMI and muscle mass to you.
But
at that point in time, I had not, it kind of concerned me a little bit. I'm like, why did I suddenly, put on, it wasn't much, but what happened? And I was talking to my dietitian about it. She said, Sue, you just finished physical therapy. You put on muscle. And you're continuing to do stuff at home. You gain muscle mass. I'm like, that explains why I don't feel any different. Thank you.
Right.
Because I didn't feel any different at all. There was no issue with clothes. There's no issue with anything. Yeah. And I'm like, but what is what's going on here? And but it was just funny that my doctor really started looking at them like, just don't go there. Just don't go there, because if you do, I will follow up and you're not going to like it.
Well, I think that there is so much misinformation about weight loss. There is so much misinformation about what people should weigh or BMI. And I think, I literally just saw something where somebody claimed to lose like 10 pounds in 3 hours. Come on. Okay. Come
Excuse
on.
Me?
Yeah. 10 pounds in 3 hours. And it's
first of all, I call bull. Second of all, I have a real concern for your health.
Right. Well, and it's so frustrating to see that, because there are so many, particularly young people, who are falling into this idea that skinny equals optimal health. And just like you said, when it comes to true health, you cannot look at a person and say, wow, they're completely healthy.
And one of the things when I first went into recovery and started working with a dietitian, I had to learn how to eat.
Yes.
And that sounds really weird, but here's the thing. Fats, proteins, and carbs are all needed on a daily, consistent, balanced way.
Correct.
Fats are the only thing that protect your bodily organs, your vital organs, and give you a sensation of being full.
Yeah.
Carbs are the only thing that give your brain energy. And protein is the only thing that rebuilds your strength.
Yeah.
So if our body is designed to need all three, and diets are based on restriction, why are we going against how our body is designed?
That's right.
So in my case, because I had cheated my body of the proper nutrition for so many years, when I say I had to learn how to eat, first of all, I had to get used to listening to my hunger cues, because I had learned to shut them down by snacking. So because if I wasn't hungry, I didn't have to feel and think and deal. So with all that, my homework my first week for my dietitian was just, when you're hungry, eat. I just had
that's
to get
hard.
Used to
thinking, yes.
Like, oh my gosh, was it ever?
Yes.
Was it ever? And then we moved into just breakfast. just work on your exchanges for breakfast. And what I mean by exchanges is my meal plan's based on the diabetic exchange system, where based on the serving size of a food label, you will see, say the serving size is a half cup. Half cup's going to have so many micrograms of fats, carbs, and proteins in it. Mm-hmm. And then you take that and then figure out how many, you know, grams of that equal one serving of something, you know, and you kind of figure it out. So, and that was really frustrating and really confusing for a long time.
Yeah.
Because all of the eating disorder whispers of you're so stupid, why can't you figure this out?
Mm-hmm.
Really, really loud.
Yep.
And we talked a whole lot about that. But I still remember the day when my brain started to clear. My dietitian kept telling me, you are not your eating disorder. That's your eating disorder voice. That's not you. And because the longer you are in a disorder and an addiction, you become enmeshed with it. And you can't tell yourself from something else.
Right.
It just is. And that was such a critical point. So I remember it probably took a couple months, but I remember being in the little kitchenette at work. And one of my red flags is if I get overwhelmed with food choices, I just shut the refrigerator door and say, screw it, I'll just go snack. So that was happening at work. But one of the things, as I started realizing that I'm not my eating disorder, and you may be familiar with it, a lot of people, you know, find it beneficial and helpful to give their eating disorder a name. I named my eating disorder Ed. So I literally talked out loud to Ed, not loud for everybody in the office to hear, but enough for me to hear. And this particular day, I shut the door. I was getting ready just to skip it. And I'm like, Ed, shut up. That's all
great.
I would say. Anytime that happened, I would just say, Ed, shut up.
Yeah.
Just shut up.
Yeah.
That's all I would say. And then the key to it, though, is doing the exact opposite of what your eating disorder voice is telling you to do.
Yes.
So Ed was telling me it's too much. You can't make a food choice. You can't decide you want to get yogurt or cheese out of your refrigerator of your meal.
Right.
You know? I had a 50-50 chance and I got it wrong, you know? instead of that, it was, no, shut up. And I'm going to make myself do this.
Right.
So what ended up happening though, is that this particular day I was starting to, you know, my body was starting to recover a little bit. And I remember how clear my brain was. It literally felt like my brain was splitting because I was like, my brain feels more clear. And I didn't understand. I didn't realize or understand the eating disorder fog because again, my brain was not getting the nutrients it needed.
Yeah.
Now what my body had to learn over time was that I would take care of it. So for a while there, it was getting the good stuff and it was kind of hoarding it. And I noticed that. And I, again, talked that through with your dietitian because you know, every little thing, when you're trying to fight this thing, you talk about every little thing.
Yes. Yes.
So we talked about that. And she said, Sue, just keep doing what you're doing. As your body learns that it can trust you and that you are going to give it what it needs on a consistent, balanced basis, it will level out. Mm-hmm. And it did.
Yeah.
Because my body knows that I've learned to listen to it and I've learned to respond to it.
Right.
So even though there was that initial, you know, my body was reacting and hoarding and I felt that and I kind of had that bloated feeling. That dissipated as my body realized that there was a new normal and it could trust in that normal.
And that takes a long time to get to that adjustment.
Oh yeah.
So Sue, how did you learn? Because sometimes people don't even recognize that their eating is disordered, especially when, you know, it's not your typical anorexia or bulimia. How did you discover that, and maybe you already knew the whole time, but how did you discover that you were struggling with an eating disorder?
I knew, but I didn't know.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that was I would call it anorexic tendencies or odd eating behaviors. But I never called it an eating disorder because to me that was meant it was really bad.
Yeah.
And I had it under control because eating disorders are about control.
Right.
Equals lie. So what happened for me was that I had for a number of years there, people weren't sure what to say. They were concerned. I remember going to my pastor's house for Christmas Eve, you know, dinner after Christmas Eve service, my roommate and I, and they were serving the food. And I remembered they were fixing my plate, but they looked at my roommate to see if the serving size was okay.
Really?
But no one ever said, Sue, I'm concerned because I see these behaviors.
Huh?
No one. But they all knew it. Yeah. But so what ended up happening though, is that even though I have that situation where people knew and didn't know what to say, what kicked it for me was I had someone speak into my life. Mm-hmm. And what I have learned, and when I speak, I say this, is that you have to be bold to express the concern, but there are so many cautions in what and how and when. Mm-hmm. And the first caution is, are you the right person? Because as with any addiction, there are a lot of defenses.
Right.
The person involved is living in a lie. So therefore, the lie is truth to them.
Right.
You are coming up against someone who can't tell truth from lie. Mm-hmm. And they've been duped and they've been enmeshed in it. And it's not their fault. It's the nature of the addiction.
That's right.
So you have to be the right person, first of all. Not everyone is going to take that expression of concern. I'm not saying confrontation, the expression of concern from everybody.
That's right.
You have to be the right person. So if you are that right person.
Well, I'm just curious because, and you're going to answer my second question, so I'm just going to let you talk on that one. But how do you know if you're not the right person?
That's a great question. I think you have in your gut, you know, if you can have those deep level conversations. If your relationship is more of that of an acquaintance or a fun, let's go out kind of friend, mm-hmm. and more, for lack of a better phrase, surfacey.
Yeah.
And, you know, good for companionship and laughs.
Right,
hang out. Let's go have coffee. But we're not really having, you haven't had a real heart to heart.
Yeah.
Your other person's not opening up to you and you don't feel safe opening up to them.
Right.
That's your idea. There you go right there. Mm-hmm. If the foundation of the relationship is such that it's more of social, mm-hmm. or more of a convenience and not in it for the long haul, if you're in it up on your knees, I'm in there with you.
Yeah.
That's how you know. Because, you know, I could have people say something to me and I'd be like, you don't know me.
Right. Right.
You know about me, but you don't know me. I think you have to evaluate what's the depth and level of the relationship of what you feel with that person.
Right.
And they feel with you, because if you likewise don't feel safe or comfortable opening up to that person, not going to take it from you.
Yeah, exactly.
Because you're going to be another person saying the same old thing that everybody else is saying, and you don't know them.
And I would add too, because I think for some reason with weight, I don't know if we do this with anything else, but I would add if you have somebody in your life that is hounding you on, you know, I'm going to call them names so that they stop eating, or I'm going to call them names so they keep eating, or whatever it may be. That just doesn't
work. I'm having a reaction.
I know. So if that would not be a safe person, obviously, to have that conversation with.
You are expressing literally a concern over the life or death of that person.
Yeah.
You are loving them enough to put the relationship on the line.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you'll know by evaluating the depth of the relationship.
That's good. Okay. So I interrupted you. So what does that look like? What are you saying? So go ahead.
So when you know you're the right person.
Yeah.
When you address it and how you address it makes a world of difference, because terminology is everything to someone caught up in an eating disorder.
Yes.
Because if you look at them and say, man, you really lost a lot of weight, that's validation to them that, hey, it works.
Yeah. Thank you.
Therefore, yeah. I have no reason to change my life.
That's right. That's right.
As compared to, I'm concerned for you because I've noticed after dinner, you tend to isolate and go to your room by yourself each night. Mm-hmm. And I miss that interaction. Isn't that a whole different message?
Yeah. And we're not even talking about weight. We're not even talking about food. Yes, exactly.
You're talking about observable behavior.
That's great.
Or, you know, I've noticed in our interactions that there seems to be some tension that isn't usually there.
Right.
Can we talk about that? I don't like that. I value our relationship too much to let that go.
I love that.
You know, coming at it from the I statement, the basic communication thing, not you. Because if I look at you and say, Stephanie, you, what's your initial reaction? Your walls,
right? Exactly. Offensive.
But if I say, Stephanie, I'm concerned when I see this. Not I'm concerned for you, because again, it's you.
Yeah.
But take the person out of it and focus on the behavior.
Yeah.
Because the observable behavior can't be denied.
Right.
Now they may argue interpretation. Mm-hmm. That's a different ballgame. But you already have common ground that the behavior is not being argued. They're not denying that they isolate. They're denying why they isolate.
Yes.
That's two different things. You look for the common ground first, and then you build from there.
That's good. So how long did it take you to get from eating disorder to, okay, I'm in recovery. I'm doing much better.
I started with a dietitian in July of 2016. So I am just coming into 6 years.
Wow.
And so I would say that I started my recovery journey. I mean, I was in counseling long before then. I'm still in counseling. I still have the same counselor.
Counseling's a good thing.
Oh my gosh. I wouldn't be here without it. Holy smokes. I am so blessed with my counselor. First weekend in April, we are going to celebrate 14 years.
Oh, wow. That's great.
And I have gone places I didn't know I needed to go.
Yeah.
And I definitely needed to go there.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. And she specializes in eating disorders, which makes life
better. Yes. Yes.
Oh, yeah. And grief. So we get through, lose a mom. And so I have the creme de la creme. So, but in terms of when I entered recovery, when I started meeting with a dietitian and went back to get my meal plan, to me, that is when I started recovery. Mm-hmm. Now, recovery doesn't mean it's done.
No.
Recovery doesn't mean you've arrived.
Nope.
Because I haven't arrived.
Right.
But that's the day that I drew the line in the sand and did a 180 and started to get out of the hole that I dug. Therefore, I was in recovery.
That's a beautiful way to say that. I absolutely love that, because we're going to have days that are more difficult, or we're going to have days where it seems, you know, it's your comfort or your go-to, and it's overcoming those things. I mean, that's what resilience is all about. That's I love how you said that. That's amazing.
And to that point, you know, I just met my dietitian 2 days ago. I met my counselor last night, and I've had some of those off days over the last couple of weeks. I'm aware of them.
Right.
I'm doing what I can to fight them. And part of that is telling my dietitian about it. Yeah. So we could kind of work through, and we came up with a plan, and that I told her, I said that takes the pressure off. Mm-hmm. Just already knowing that takes the pressure off. Now I can come home and execute it after I get off work. But in the course of that conversation, I had not made this connection. And part of me is like, you've been doing this long enough. Why didn't you make that connection? I'm like, you know what, Ed, shut up. You know?
That's right.
Because that's my eating disorder voice claiming and shaming me.
That's right.
And instead of buying into that, it's simply, okay, I have now learned that the work my counselor and I are doing on some unexpected triggers is stirring a lot emotionally that I may not realize on the outside, but that's what's happening. And that's why suddenly my red flags are coming up. Why I'm seeing this happen or that happen. And that also was very enlightening for me and helped me take myself off the hook.
Yeah.
Because then I understood, I didn't have to get mad at myself because I understood it was the eating disorder raising its ugly head in relation to emotions that right. I'm having trouble dealing with. Mm-hmm. Deja vu way back when to college. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It all started. So yes, it can still come up and try to sneak up from behind. But when you have that recovery team and when you have some distance behind you, you are more attuned to the tactics.
Exactly.
And then you realize, you know what? You really are not creative, are you?
you keep telling me the same stuff over and over
again. You really think I'm going to buy into that this time? You might have duped me for a second, but really?
Yeah.
Well, you're really boring.
I love that. Well, and it's all about feeling those feelings, those emotions, and being willing to sit with those. And that's uncomfortable. That is not fun. Yeah.
Because when you're active in your disorder, feelings are the enemy.
Yeah.
And therefore food is the enemy.
Yeah.
And you're, it's hard enough to have to deal with the food.
Yeah.
But when you are dealing with the cause of the issues behind the food being the issue,
right?
It is a double-edged sword. Yeah. I took a year off from writing my book when I first went into recovery because that was also the time I was finally dealing with the rape over four decades after the event. It was all I could do to focus on getting through the day. Wow. So what, and as I look back, that was one of the best things of self-care I could do was just put the book on the shelf and just do the hard work of healing, knowing the book would take care of itself when it was time. Okay. That actually was not a disappointment. That was the best thing I could have done for me and for the finished product.
Good for you. So what a fabulous segue. Why don't you tell us about your book?
That was not planned, but sure. I do have one nearby. This is
perfect.
The book. It's called This Much I Know, The Space Between.
Mm.
And it's on Amazon and Kindle. And the concept, the book is my story.
Yeah.
The first half of the book, let me back up. The concept of the title is that This Much I Know is my story. All of us have a story.
Yes.
Your life is your story. That is the one thing no one can ever take from any of us. The second half, The Space Between, talks about the healing journey of going from having wounds to having scars and that process. I go into much more detail about a number of different things of that happened when I was growing up and through college and after college, all of how that common thread of woundedness and how it kept piling on and piling on and piling on. And I wasn't digging out. And then the second half talks about the healing journey. My healing started in 2014. So it's only been 7.5 years. I guess going on 8 years now.
Yeah.
And that was the year we were dealing with the rape, but it not oddly enough or coincidentally enough, what's the word I'm looking for? Purposefully enough. There was a retreat that I went on in the fall. Earlier in the year, there was a movie that came out about Rich Mullins. He's a big Christian musician by 1997. His big song is Awesome God. And they did a movie about his life. And the first 20 minutes were a really hard watch for me because they hit home.
Wow.
But again, I wasn't in recovery and I didn't want to be found out because I had put on all these masks that Sue was okay.
Yeah.
Together. So even when I'm wiping tears, I'm like doing this, this doesn't matter in my life.
Yeah.
That thing. So anyway, so in the fall, they did a retreat to carry on the conversation about the themes. And I was supposed to go to Nashville to see friends. And I just kind of kept feeling that heart tug. And I was going this way with that heart tug. And I was in a push me, pull you situation. And I finally gave in. So I signed up for the retreat. With the retreat, they opened up a Facebook room a couple weeks before the retreat. So anyone who's going on the retreat can get to know each other.
This first year,
there were 50 of us. We were all total strangers. The only thing we had in common was this movie.
They asked
us to share our story.
Oh my God.
I had never shared my story publicly, never about the rape or anything. So I lurked and I stalked everybody else for about 3 days, commented, encouraged, liked, that kind of thing, but wasn't telling mine. And then one morning, you know how you get the heart just pounding out of your chest and you start to sweat? That I was like, okay, it's my turn. Literally put on a pot of coffee. And for the first 30 minutes, typed out my story for the first time ever. I was shaking. I was crying. I was a mess. It was literally 4 o'clock in the morning. And I hit post. And I expected to be trashed the rest of the day because that's all I had ever known. Yeah. So why would I expect anything else? We are now 7.5 years past that first post. I have yet to hear one negative comment.
Oh, wow.
Not one. Okay. Instead, it was, you are so brave.
Yes. I want to give
you a hug. I appreciate you. Wow, thank you for sharing. All I want to meet you. All these things. That started my healing journey because I had a place where it was okay to not be okay.
Yes.
That weekend, I went into that weekend calling myself the holy exception. I was imploding again. I was not doing well. I was starting down the spiral and I had convinced myself, no, I had bought into the lie.
Yeah, right.
I was a waste of space. I called myself the holy exception, that everything in the Bible was good enough for everybody else but me. Wow. So I was too screwed up, too far gone, waste of space. Over the course of the weekend, I left there saying for the first time and starting to believe that Jesus Christ loves me. And he not only loves me, he actually likes me.
Yeah.
And then he's absolutely crazy about me.
And he knows everything about you and still likes you. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yes. And so that started it. And a staff member has since said, that first retreat was like a Hail Mary for me. Mm-hmm. Was I lovable? Could God really love me? Could his kids love me? Mm-hmm. And I found a place where it was true. And that now is now called Walking Stick Retreats. We have a retreat twice a year. It is open to anybody.
Oh,
our next one, I don't know when this is going to air. Our next one is the last weekend of April, April 29th through May 1st.
It should air in April, the beginning of April, I think. So,
So, and they can go to walkingstickretreats.org. Yeah. Then we got something coming up in the fall. So it's open to anybody. It is a safe place where you can just be.
You can
fight with God. You can wrestle. You can, have questions.
Yeah.
You can just kind of soak it all in. Whatever you need to do for you on your journey. So that started things. The first year, and I go into more of this whole into the book. This is all in the book. That first year I had to own my story, and this gets in that whole healing journey because I was in denial about my story. I didn't like my story.
Yeah.
I hated my story.
Right.
That's why I didn't want to tell anybody.
Right.
So, because if I didn't tell anybody, nobody had to know. And therefore it really happened. It was all fake.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So the first year I owned my story and there were a lot of tears around that.
What I now call
my sacred moment of release. The next year, and this is an important part that I think people don't think about or gloss over, I had to grieve my story.
Yes.
My story has a lot of loss in it.
Yes.
And the sacred moment of release the second year resulted in me heave crying for about 15 minutes of that heart.
Yeah.
That heart. And yet, not one negative comment. Someone actually came over to me, put his arm around me, and I later found out, prayed, God, whatever it is, put it on me. That's the community that is involved in this. And that's the caliber of love, these things.
Wow.
The third year is where things started to turn for me. And this is when I started writing the book. And it was, I left the retreat with the morsel that I am valuable to God. When I dared to believe that I mattered.
Yeah.
That's when things started to change. Mm. That's when everything else started happening. And it has just been a continual growth process since. I always get some kind of morsel. There's nothing special or magical about retreat. And I'm try very hard to make this point. What happens at the retreat is that the staff gets out of the way and lets the Holy Spirit do his job.
Yep.
That's what happens there. Right. It is different for each person.
Yeah.
For me, when I came, I was so broken. I didn't even think Humpty Dumpty was going to have enough glue to put it back together again.
Yeah.
I was heading down the implosion road. I was probably going to be heading towards self-harm in the very near future. So there's nothing magical about the retreat. It is simply the power of love. Mm. So all that is in the book and a whole lot more.
That is great.
The book came out September 2019. In November 2020, it won second place nonfiction at the Faith and Fellowship Book Festival.
That's so fabulous. Congratulations. I
was excited. It's my first book. It's self-published and it won an award. So for me, that was validation that I'm doing something that God wants me to do.
Yeah. So I love that.
I have concepts for books 2, 3, and 4. I'm just starting on number 2 right now.
Yeah.
And
that's awesome.
It's good. It's if my story can help somebody else, I want to share it.
Mm, that's so good.
The bottom line of it. I used to be really hacked off at God.
Yeah.
Why did any of these things that have happened in my life are a lot for anybody to handle? And all of it has happened in my life.
Mm.
I was hacked off. Why? You must hate me.
Yeah.
Why did you let this happen? And you know, I'm not getting into the theology of it all. But what I have learned and come to appreciate is that I now have opportunity and I don't want to say right, but I have authenticity to relate to a large number of people.
Mm.
And I wish it was, I wish there weren't those people out there that needed to relate to them.
Right.
But at the same time, I am thankful for what God has done in my life to allow me to be one of those people that can now relate to others. My business name is My Step Ahead. The concept is that you only have to be a step ahead to help the person behind you.
Oh, neat. So many times
we do like to think we have to have it all figured out. That we have nothing to offer because I'm a screw up or I don't have this little corner of my life, you know, all in a row or whatever. And people aren't going to like me or accept me or feel me qualified or whatever. That's a bunch of baloney.
Yeah.
You only have to be a step ahead. You have walked a journey that someone else is also walking.
Mm.
And you can help that person with the knowledge you have, no matter how big or small that knowledge is.
Yeah.
So while I'm still reaching out for help to help me in my next step, I want to reach back and help the person who's behind me.
Right.
And together we have a whole human chain of support.
Mm, that's neat.
That is what My Step Ahead is about. That is what Sue Bowles Coaching is all about, is helping people take that next step.
That's beautiful.
What it's about. That's what my life is about now. And it's an honor and a privilege when someone lets me into their life to help them take that next step. And I don't take that lightly.
Yeah. Yeah. That is beautiful. So Sue, how can people get in touch with you? How can people utilize you as a coach and find your book?
Yes. Best place is suebowles.com. It's B-O-W-L-E-S. There's a link to the book there. You can send me a message through the website and I'll be in touch with you within 24 hours and we can get to work. If there's a podcast someone's wanting me to speak on or a conference or I do all that, but I also really just enjoy the one-on-one or group coaching. And just real quickly, coaching and counseling are two different things.
Right.
Counseling deals with the past to bring you to the present.
Mm-hmm.
Coaching is what I do. And coaching takes you in the present and helps you get where you want to go.
Right.
So I want to make sure I'm clear about that delineation.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean you can't contact me in the course of our conversations. If I feel there's something that would be better served in counseling, we'll talk about that.
Right. Right.
That doesn't mean I can't help you in coaching at the same time. I have clients who are seeing a counselor and we still coach.
Yeah,
because we're working on two different things.
Sure, absolutely.
And that's my obligation and commitment to my clients. That's what I'm trained to do, is know where those boundaries are. So don't make that decision for yourself.
That's
because
fantastic.
Most likely there's something lying in your head anyway, because they don't want you to change.
That's right.
So it's a privilege. I'm honored, you know, to be able to do that. I also have just a little tip sheet I like to give out. It's called 5 Tips to Being Unshakable. Right.
Oh, great.
And so if anyone wants to sign up for that, they can go to the website and sign up for that as well. And I'll get that to them.
Oh, I love that. I love that. You, just an inspiration. I love that you are using your story to help other people. And that is really what it's all about. You are doing some amazing things, and you are very courageous. I think that that is something that is evident, and what a blessing that is to you. Yeah, thank you. Okay, so final question.
Yes.
What does resilience mean to you?
Resilience means defining the events and not letting them define you.
Mm. Oh, I like that. That's good. That's good. Well, this has been a pleasure. I hope we can stay connected for sure.
Yes. Yes.
What a great work you're doing. And I am getting your book. So absolutely.
You.
No, thank you. And thank you for being on the show. And everybody reach out to Sue, buy her book, and utilize that to go that next step in your journey. And I thank you for joining us on Resilience and Life and Leadership. We'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening. Please share with anyone you think will benefit from this podcast.